Blog Talk Radio.
Going into the corner, Gordie Howe goes in to fight for it. He and Zygenkov have it. Back to Walt, not in front. Here's Bobby Hull, shoots first! Bobby Hull!
Judol tried to make a play. Lemieux steals, and he's up against Raymond Bork and Adam Oates. Coming to the Bruins, they got around both men. Cutting for the net, he's in on goal. Hey! Charlton scores! What a goal!
Brune carries in, rolling in front of him, and in a shot! Desjardins following the play, and he misses the short cut. Here he is again! Scores! Desjardins!
It is still for waiting.
All right, hockey fans, you're listening to the hard-checking, kick-saving, sudden-death scoring NHL Breakdown. I'm your host, Scott Levy, joined as always by George Kurtz of RotoExperts.com. We're bringing you all the on- and off-ice action, as well as keeping you fans and you fantasy owners fully informed with our fantasy reports, including the IR, line updates, goalie report, and waiver wire recommendations. Today is, of course, Monday, December 3rd, starting that second third of this National Hockey League season. Always very exciting, as I've teased a couple times in the last couple shows, George and I, and maybe even our special guest, Jan Levine, joining us once again today. Will be joining us for our soon-to-be-rolled-out power rankings. We'll have probably in about a week, some next two or three shows, we'll probably roll those out and then spend a couple of shows breaking those down. Lots to talk about today. Seattle expansion, a virtual guarantee. It's not official yet, but tomorrow morning, actually I think it might be this morning, they are going to be having an official vote, and it is expected that they will be overwhelmingly approved for a new Seattle franchise, the 32nd in the NHL. I'm also going to talk about some disciplinary cases because it's Tom Wilson, man, and we just have to for some reason. But, yeah, it's just with all the headlines that he creates and everybody up in arms anytime he sneezes, right or wrong, we simply have to cover that as well as a couple other hits. Talk about that, and then, of course, have our fantasy reports as usual. As I just teased, Jan Levine rejoining us once again today and in time for this Seattle expansion discussion. As I said, Jen and George, you know, this is a virtual guarantee. It's expected that the fait accompli, once the vote officially comes through, $650 million expansion fee. That is 30% higher than Vegas. And Vegas wasn't cheap, to say the least. Seattle is going to have to put down a $200 million check this week, assuming everything goes smoothly today and tomorrow and this week at the Board of Governors meetings. And then also this week they are putting a shovel into dirt on the $600 million renovation of the key arena that the Seattle expansion team will at least start playing off in once they do come into existence. The biggest question really is whether they're going to start in 2020 or 2021. The arena issue is probably the biggest hurdle there. Seattle would like to start in 2020, but it's already had delays with the arena issue. So they're looking at realistically, even if they're ready for 2020, it probably won't be until November. So Seattle will have to go on a month-long road trip to start their inaugural season. At least that's the way it would seem. So the NHL favoring 2021, at least this is what rumor is saying. And then, of course, finally, one of the things we'll touch on eventually, not right away, but with Seattle coming into the National Hockey League, that's going to force realignment once again because it's the Central Division that has just the seven teams and the other three divisions, the eight teams, not going to have nine teams in the Pacific. Somebody's got to go to the Central. At least that's what it would seem. So we'll talk about that and the likely rumor of who is believed to be the one to move there. So let's kick things off and just get some reaction from you boys. Jen, let's start with you since you're our sort of returning champion or returning special guest. What do you think about this Seattle expansion? Is this the right move? Does this move make sense to complete 32 teams? I've been saying for a couple of years, even before Vegas came in, even before Vegas approved, Seattle is in the eye of, you know, the eyes on the ball, you know, or Seattle's in the National Hockey League's eye, at least in my opinion, it seems to make a lot of sense. But because you have realignment that is now forced upon us, maybe this isn't such a logical thing. So, Jan, do you like it? Does it make sense to you? And do you think this is maybe watering down the product too much, getting to 32, or is 32 just right the number? Jen, welcome back, and what do you think about Seattle?
First, thanks for welcoming me back, Scott. Good to be back again, and good to be on with George again. In terms of Seattle, I think everybody kind of viewed it as a fait accompli over the last several years that Seattle was likely next in line. I mean, Quebec had been mentioned a lot. They clearly have the arena. They have, to a certain extent. Now, whether or not they have the ticket base and the other components that the NHL are looking for is up for debate. As we've seen, they've been passed over several times. They've kind of been the bridesmaid many times, especially when it comes to either A, expansion, or B, relocating certain teams. So they've always become the default position of, well, we'll move to Quebec if things don't pan out here. Arizona was mentioned, and several other teams, including, I think, Tampa, for a while got mentioned. But right now it looks like Quebec seems to be the team that's always going to – the city that's always going to be the outskirts looking in. I personally think that Quebec would be a really good choice. I personally think that Quebec would be – would be a great addition to the NHL, given how passionate that fan base is. I mean, there's also the rumors about Toronto, in the vicinity of Toronto, Hamilton being mentioned a couple times as being another alternative. But it's kind of hard to argue with Seattle in terms of the population base, the amount of tickets that they've sold in advance in terms of the announcement coming out probably tomorrow, as you mentioned, the renovation of the Key Arena, the potential of maybe the Seattle basketball team ending up back there again, which probably never should have moved given what transpired. So it's kind of hard to argue with Seattle. I understand the questions of relocating franchises and how to kind of realign. I know I believe that Emily Miller did a whole bunch of analysis last year for ESPN in terms of potential for, you know, 8-14 divisions or even 4-18 divisions. The big rumor that I've heard a lot is Arizona potentially moving to the Central, which seem to make sense. So there will have to be some configurations and alignments to doing so. In terms of your question of watering down the product, I think what we've seen, especially with a lot of the younger players coming into the league, is that the talent base is growing. I think the bigger issue is probably defensively as opposed to offense, especially given the rules opening up the offense, that it's made it the advantageous to play younger players, getting them in the mix early on, maximizing their ELCs before they earn that second and third contract. The bigger issue has been more so on defense, and also the changes in terms of the goaltending equipment, making it easier for the offense to take advantage of those rules. So I don't think there's an issue in terms of watering down the product. I do think there's enough talent, especially as we saw last year from Vegas, where, you know, depending on if you go 7-3-1 or if you're going to go with four defensemen and how you configure your retention. And I think 2021 makes a big difference based upon teams in terms of protecting players. You know, one team being the Rangers with Philippe Hedl and Elias Anderson, now both of them off their EL, or both of them losing the ability to slide their contracts, that's going to have a material impact in terms of you have to protect. So that's an area that a lot of teams are going to have to focus on, depending if it's 2021 or 21-22 in terms of coming into the league. So I don't think we are going to have a watered-down product. If anything, you're going to start seeing a lot more of the younger names coming into the NHL earlier than expected. My only concern is whether or not they have the defensive prospects to potentially alter and mitigate what we've seen offensively up front, because to me that's the bigger issue for the NHL right now, is potentially slowing down the offensive product that we see on the ice and the amount of scoring that we've seen compared to the last couple of years.
Now, a lot of good points there in general. And like I said, I've been on the Seattle bandwagon. Not necessarily that, like, ooh, I personally desperately need Seattle to be in the NHL, but just that I thought it made sort of sense. The biggest thing, and I've repeated this whenever the subject of expansion has come up for the last couple of years, again, even predating Vegas, that Seattle made so much sense because so much of it in sports is about the national TV contract. And that's really the only section of the country in the United States, not North America, because obviously you have Vancouver there, but then you're talking the Canadian contract, you know, TV contract. But at least in terms of the American contract, TV contract, that was the only section of the country, the Northwest, that the NHL really didn't cover. And that is why I felt that Bettman really coveted Seattle all along. It's one of the reasons why I think he's been so stubbornly holding on to Arizona, which I also agree is probably the most likely to move to the Central Division if that is what it takes. And it seems like it's obvious that has to happen. So I think, like, unless the arena situation, or, you know, fell apart, and as you mentioned already or teased, you know, that's already happened at least once or twice before with Seattle, that the arena was such an issue that the NHL sort of moved away from them when they sort of was looking at them earlier and years ago, and also, you know, ownership groups falling apart previously. So, you know, outside of those two big hurdles, which are obviously big and obvious, I thought Seattle was sort of like the fait accompli, and I do think that the NHL, once again, Bettman for years when he started the expansion years and years ago, I think they always thought that 32 was the number. I think they looked at the other major sports and football and things like that and saying, hey, 32 is the number that we're shooting for. So I don't expect them like necessarily going for more expansion teams than any other cities that come on the docket for a possible like NHL city going there. I think is really a more expansion thing. I think if it wasn't for, you know, the overloaded East, Quebec City that you brought up, Jan, sort of would have been filled years ago. And for the last couple of years, I've been saying that, hey, if there's an Eastern Conference team that has to move, and I know there was some talk about, you know, Carolina before the ownership changed there, at least, you know, or any other team in the East that might be struggling, I think Quebec is sort of, you know, 1A on the list for them to go to. But because that there's no more room to fit more teams in, I think that, you know, that sort of puts them on the sidelines, at least for now. George, so obviously I'm kind of curious if you like this move, if you think it makes sense as well, but I want you to sort of delve more into the realignment issue. I mean, as you know, Jan just teased, Arizona is the team that is rumored most likely to be moved. Obviously, as I just teased and we've talked about in years past, Bettman's been pretty stubborn in sticking with the Arizona market, but there has been some whispers last 6 months to a year that, okay, even Bettman's kind of tiring of it now, and everything's not completely settled down. They're still up a little bit up in the air in terms of their long-term future of an arena and that sort of situation. So you can see the NHL souring on that. So there's a couple things here that a lot of people don't realize. Arizona doesn't adhere, or at least the state of Arizona, to daylight saving time. So they are actually only an hour difference rather than 2 hours difference, being where they are logistically, to the Central Division, which might not seem that big of a deal, but it's not something to be overlooked either. And also, if you're sort of going to further the idea of maybe Arizona being in trouble in terms of the NHL staying there, there's also been whispers about if Arizona were to move, Houston makes a lot of sense as a place to them to move. And Kansas City a couple of years ago was courting the Islanders pretty hard. You know, so it seems like there's some relocation ideas there. So, George, obviously, what's your impression of Seattle? Does it make sense to you? And does this idea that everybody's talking about of Arizona work? Do all the pieces now fall into place in your mind, or are there some issues here that concern you? George?
Well, there are always going to be issues that concern me. Once again, the NHL is not going to do what's best for hockey. They're going to do what's best as far as money is concerned. We see that over and over again. That's how they adjust their schedule. That's how they do their divisions. That's how they do the playoff matchups the way they do it. They want as less traveling as possible, once again, saving money. The NHL doesn't run itself like football does or baseball does. As far as the divisions, someone has to move. Right? I mean, personally, I prefer 8-4 team divisions, but I doubt that's going to happen. The NHL seems to work go backwards. They're going to what Major League Baseball was, let's say, in the year before realignment, where they went to you know, 4 divisions of 8 teams rather than 1 baseball. Now they've broken it down. I don't think the NHL is going to go to 4-8s. That would require too many teams to make sacrifices and all this other crap that the NHL is worried about here. Arizona, maybe are they in the Central? Of course they're not. But we've seen this before. I mean, Dallas Cowboys, left the hurt arm in the East, but they play in the NFC East. Right? That's just the way it works out. You got to live with it here. The most important thing for the NHL, once again, is money. And all these owners are going to get a slice of this pie. You already mentioned the finances involved here with Seattle. I'm sure there'll be some back deals we made for someone to move and live with it here. Maybe Arizona, because they're Arizona. Sort of an afterthought in the NHL. They're the team that has to move here. You mentioned the Houston market. Houston, I think, is a top 6 television market in the country. So you're absolutely right that the NHL would like to get a team there. Once again, it's TV. It's where money is. So I think you'll hear their name mentioned more and more, especially more than a Canadian team. One, for the geographical reasons you mentioned, that those would have problems there, and also because, once again, they want teams in the United States. Is more money here. It's just the way it is. So Seattle's going to get their team. You know, I think I will disagree with Jan as far as the product is going to be diluted. I mean, you don't have 32 goaltenders now. I mean, now you're getting another team. You're at Vegas. You don't have enough goaltenders. You certainly don't have enough defensemen to go around. You know, offense, I agree. I think there's plenty of offense to go around. But defense and goaltending is going to be watered down. But I don't think the NHL cares about that. Once again, that's probably good for the game. High scoring. They prefer the more goals to go in. Every rule in football is designed for scoring. Scoring attracts viewers. Attracts ratings. Money. So I'm not surprised about that at all. They don't care about that. All they care about is the bottom line here. And listen, I'm not really denigrating them. That's business. That's democracy, business, capitalism. Make money. And that's what the NHL is worried about here. But like I said, personally, I look at it more from the fan perspective. How can you make the game better? And for me, I prefer the 8-14 divisions. I think it makes more sense. I'm a guy, I think I've said this before, they'll never go back as far as playoff seedings to 1 versus 16, but I think that's the fairest thing to do. But I would certainly rather go back to the 1 versus 8 rather than this idiotic system they do here. But once again, it comes down to money. Less travel means they can save money.
Everything that's said makes sense. And I think the NHL, you know, again, jumping off what both you guys are saying, I think they're going to, in their minds, it's going to be like you just sort of described it, George. I think they're going to sort of take advantage of this, quote-unquote, watered-down goaltending and defenseman, at least, you know, for a couple of years, to promote, okay, offense, that sells the game. As you said, I don't think they're really minded, especially with the rules, similar to football, sort of gravitating to a little bit more of offense. And then I think in a couple of years that defense and goaltending will catch up at least a little bit. But to the point that you just made, George, I don't think the NHL minds it whatsoever. George, if we're just talking about things that we can make changes for that we would prefer, I am so right there, lockstep with you in terms of the divisions of four teams, eight divisions of four teams. I think it would make sort of not so much so much more sense, you know. And if the NHL, you know, and I've talked about this before, I think, you know, with the sort of playoff, you know, alignment, the way that they have, that's favoring your divisional opponents, they're doing it for a reason to sort of, you know, especially with the newer teams, to sort of drive those rivalries and really sort of grow the fan bases that way. Because then, as I made this example, George, I became a hockey fan because of Rangers Islander rivalries of the 80s, despite the fact that the Islanders were dominating the Rangers at that point, at least when I was sort of became cognizant of hockey, even though it was painful. But, you know, just that intense rivalry. So I get what they're doing, but I also agree with you, and I've said this before, that I don't quite like it, especially from the playoff standpoint, and I'd much rather go to that conference realignment. And I said they're going to go back to it, but I don't think it's going to be for a good 5 years. I think they're going to sort of sit on this system that they have, both divisional alignment and the playoff alignment, you know, in terms of who you're going to play, you know, for a good 5-6 years, maybe even 10 years, for the reasons that I said, to sort of push those rivalries, and then I think they'll gravitate back to the fairer, you know, conference, you know, sort of alignment, at least in terms of when it comes to playoff seeding, you know. But yeah, those things are never going to happen. And if you look at the map, you know, having those divisions of four teams really sort of makes a lot more sense in terms of clustering the teams together in terms of their rivalries of the, you know, the Southwest United States and the Northwestern Canadian and now American area of the country and the continent. You know, really, Colorado's the only team that's kind of on its own, you know, logistically. So I think long-term it would make so much more sense. But again, George, to everything that you already said, I don't think that's going to happen. Even if it were going to happen, it's not going to happen for years. Years and years and years. All right, let's talk about a little bit of discipline, which isn't always the funnest thing, especially since it seems like we're saying the same thing over and over. But again, as I said at the top of the show, I don't feel like we can really ignore it. And just because of the headlines, and it's Tom Wilson, and he seems to be really controversial, so this also is a question I'm going to ask both of you guys. When it comes to this latest Tom Wilson hit, because I'm going to sort of take the chance and be a little bit devil advocate here and sort of maybe at least quasi go on Tom Wilson's side here, or at least, you know, edge my bets a little bit. But I'm just not sure if all the hubbub of people yelling and screaming was really because the hit was as bad as people were screaming about, or because it's Tom Wilson. He has the history of this. I mean, yes, he came from behind, did he make any head contacts? I sort of got the arm in my mind. Am I completely, you know, just playing devil's advocate to giving you guys a target to yell at because I'm completely wrong? or am I onto something here that it's Tom Wilson? So everybody's freaking out because it's Tom Wilson. So, Jen, going back to you again, this latest hit, is this another example of why Tom Wilson should not be playing in the National Hockey League, or am I onto something that people are overreacting because it's Tom Wilson? Jen, what do you think?
I mean, I think it's got to be a combination of both. Do I think the hit, and it's pretty bad that I'm qualifying Tom Wilson hits now, so that gives you a sense as to where we are when it comes to him. But compared to some of the other hits that he's had, probably not at the level that we've seen in the past. It's interesting. I was at the Vic Hatfield retirement game yesterday. I got a chance to catch up with Rick Carpinello, who covers the Rangers for the Athletic, and we got into a bit of a conversation on Tom Wilson. And kind of both of our views were that Wilson has gotten himself enough street cred, for lack of a better term, that he really doesn't have to go over the line. And if he could ever find a way to play to the line, just to the line, or maybe even an inch or two over that line, he's given himself enough leeway now that on the ice that guys know that he's dangerous and he doesn't have to play that game anymore. He's become a prototypical power forward to a certain extent because of the fact he's willing to take the punishment. He's willing to go to the front of the net. He balances out the Alexander Ovechkin and Nicholas Backstrom line. I mean, Ovi's one of those who I've said in the past, kind of goes over the line at times in terms of the way that he checks, in terms of the speed he builds up, leaving the ice on his checks, but he won't get called because of the fact that he's Alexander Ovechkin. I'm not saying that he needs to be called in a lot of times, but there are certain instances where he's kind of gone over the line and gotten a pass because his name is Alexander Ovechkin and not necessarily Tom Wilson. So to me, do I think this hit was probably warranted of a suspension? Likely no. Do I think the NHL has done an absolutely horrific job? And this goes into the guys who were in the role beforehand, Brendan Shanahan and Matthew Schneider, now leading up even to Joris Parros, who's taken over that role, of sending the right message to the league. I thought that the 20-game suspension Wilson had gotten maybe will have, you know, modified his game a little bit and mollified in terms of the type of style that he plays. Maybe it's kind of giving him a little bit in the back of his head to maybe change up the manner in which he plays. That has not been the case, especially since the arbitrator reduced the sentence to a certain extent. So the problem with me is that Wilson is always going to go over that line. And the problem becomes in terms of how do you rein him in, but also send a message to the rest of the league that this style of play is unacceptable. We've seen the type of injuries that have resulted. We've seen the impact on the headshots. And I'm not sure if you guys discussed it. I'm sure you did in terms of the settlement that took place from the concussions, which, in my opinion, was an absolute joke. And why there's going to be a lot of people that whoever signed up are going to opt out. And you didn't see a lot of the big names signing up to that settlement. And I applaud all the work that Dan Carcillo is doing, you know, in the forefront, in the background, to try to raise the awareness of concussions and CTE and all the other trauma that takes place associated with it. But to me, I don't think this one warranted a potential suspension, which is why probably the NHL ruled that way. But I also believe that the NHL as a whole has done a very poor job of sending a consistent message and basically saying that all headshots need to be treated accordingly. All headshots have to be evaluated appropriately. All headshots potentially are in general worthy of a penalty, B, potentially worthy of a major penalty, and C, potentially worthy of a phone or other type of hearing from the NHL, not necessarily meaning you're going to get suspended, but warrants a type of review that maybe hasn't taken place in the past, and maybe we can kind of eradicate this from the game, because right now the speed and the projected how players project forward and the projectile nature in terms of the hits that happen and the cumulative effect, I'm just worried that we're going to see a lot more instances where guys get concussed and start having more issues with CTE down the road, as opposed to the NHL taking steps to try to remediate and fix this.
I mean, such good information in that reply. I mean, and that is the thing that drives me nuts. You know, something you said there at the end, and it's something that George and I are always bringing up whenever we talk about and track these kind of, you know, disciplinary situations, whether it's specifically with Tom Wilson or other guys, is the lack of consistency. If it's something, if you're trying to drive something out of the game, you know, and I love physical hockey. You know, but I do want it as clean as possible, you know. So if you're going to make decisions about it and say, okay, we can't have certain types of hits, whether it's head hits or not, you have to sort of be consistent about it. And that's what's been so frustrating. So George, I know obviously, you know, any regular listener of the show knows you are not a Tom Wilson fan for the way that he sort of irresponsibly plays the game. So I'm particularly curious to see how you feel about this kind of thing, because – again, and I've got the replay going over and over in a loop right in front of me right now. It's a bad hit. I'm not saying it wasn't deserving of a penalty. I'm not saying it doesn't deserve, you know, at least some consideration of a disciplinary hearing, whether you found him guilty or not. But it's something that, you know, obviously grabs my attention. And I say to myself, okay, even if it's not officially an illegal hit, that is something that is a little bit bothersome. I'm personally not bothered that he didn't get a suspension. But a closer look at this, and the fact that I wasn't taking a closer look at this, and it bothers me so much. But because of how I know how you feel about Tom Wilson in general, George, and just the fact of your background as being a referee recreationally in hockey, you know, sort of brings it to the next level for me, and another reason why I always want to hear responses to these things. So I want to ask you about Tom Wilson, but then I also want to ask you about the Kunitz hit on Hamonic, but we'll get to that in a moment. So starting with Tom Wilson, George, do you feel similarly to what Jan expressed, or do you have, you know, a more nuanced kind of feelings on this latest Tom Wilson hit? George?
Well, I think we all know the Department of Player Safety is a joke. Okay, it has been for a long time now. The hit, as soon as they try to defend it by saying it was incidental contact, you're suspended. Okay, because that's admitting that you did it on purpose. That was not incidental contact. He was not skating at full speed. He had at least 10 feet. 10 feet for an NHL player is an eternity. He could have done a pirouette to avoid this guy easily. He did not make any attempt not to hit him, and he hit him straight from behind. I don't care if there was a contact to the head or not. It's a dirty play. It's a dirty play. And I'm not saying he should have got suspended 20 games, but the Angels just say, oh, it's fine. They did the same thing with Brad Marchand last year. Right after he came back from his long suspension, he did something else stupid. They let it go. Oh, not going to suspend that. It didn't make sense then. You know, it's like also once you suspend him, you get him a big suspension once, it's okay now when he comes back. You don't want to deal with him again. It was almost reminded me of that. Like, you know, if you're a parent, and Jan is, you know, you deal with your child, you punish your child over and over again, they make the same. Sometimes you're like, you know what, I've had it. Just go. Just leave me alone. It happens to the parent. You do that. You shouldn't do it, but you do that. I'm just tired of yelling at you. I'm tired of yelling at the same thing over and over again. Stop stealing the candy. Stop stealing the candy. Take a bath. Take a bath. Take a bath. And eventually you just say, you know what, just leave me alone. Because you've had enough. And that's the first thing that came to my mind, that the Angels just didn't want to call him in again. They just had enough, you know, and they let it go. I don't like how the NHL, how different would this have been if the player was hurt? Would then we have seen a suspension? I think that's the most stupidest thing I've ever heard, by the way. That the fact that you hurt a player means you get suspended or you get suspended more. Well, some players are built differently. Some players don't get hurt as much. You see that in all sports, not just for illegal hits. Some players get hurt the drop of a dime. Other players, you can run them over with a Mack truck and they don't get hurt. So I think that's always been idiotic to me, that an injury means more. No. The only way I'd want to hear that is if you're going to suspend a player for as long as he put the injured player out. You know, when Marchand hit Burakovsky last year, if Marchand couldn't play again to an independent neurologist that Burakovsky was able to come back, then I'll hear about the injury excuse. Other than that, you're suspending the act, not for what happened after the act, not for what happened to the other player. I always think that's just completely silly here. I'm not a Tom Wilson fan as far as his actions on the ice, as far as the dirty stuff. He's an excellent player. He's a player everybody would want on their team. But if I'm also a teammate, I'm getting tired of defending this guy all the time. I mean, the coach, in the interview after the game, he's lying straight through his teeth. And does he think anybody's blind or was incidental contact? I mean, how stupid do you think we are to think it's incidental contact? Everybody knows the NHL is a dirty play. And before you get the 20-game suspension, the coach said the same thing. No, it was a perfectly fine play. It's just idiotic to me. This is the same NHL that, 2 weeks ago, Vlasic was bitten. You know, man bites shark. He was bitten by Roussel of Vancouver, and Roussel got a $5,000 fine. That's it. He bit the man, but he got a $5,000 fine. Yeah, the NHL in there, how they hand out their judgment to me is just always idiotic. I never know what direction they're going to go into. It's almost like entertainment. You know, you can go to place, you're going to be able to go to Vegas and place odds. Under the fine, suspension, in-person hearing, phone hearing, what they're going to do, because you just don't know. So, like I said, I think if this wasn't Tom Wilson, maybe you give the benefit of the doubt. If it's to a player who's had no history of anything like this, maybe give the benefit of the doubt. How Tom Wilson gets the benefit of the doubt here is beyond me. Like I said, I was not calling for a 20-game suspension here. but to just give them, hey, not even fine. What you're saying here is that the refs handled it, that's good enough, the fact that he got thrown out of the game. Really? That's good enough for you here? I mean, I might feel differently in old-time NHL, where this could be taken care of on the ice, you know, where Tiger Williams would then come over and beat the crap out of him. You know, Clark Gillies would go after him, Dave Schultz. And I also wonder the fact that you're taking fighting out of the game. I've said this before in regards to Marchand. The fact that you're trying to take fighting out of the game, a lot of the self-policing goes away with it. Because Thomas is a big guy. He can handle himself. But, you know, as an Islander fan, the Islanders hated him. And he's turned down fights. Johnson wanted to go after. He turned it down. In my mind, you're going to do the dirty crap, then you got to fight the big boys. Yeah, and like I said, I think that's what annoys probably Islander fans more than anything else. He's turned down that fight because I guess he's afraid. You know, so just I think that's today's NHL. That's the thing I worry about most, is that the self-policing. I understand people don't like fighting. I get it. But that was also self-policing, and it stopped all this crap. And now we're seeing it more and more again.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, and again, that's something that me and you have sort of semi-regularly bring up, this idea of the elimination of fighting. And I'm not a specific proponent of fighting. I really not, especially in this day and age of concussions, I just think you have to be responsible and phase it out of the game. But I really believe wholeheartedly, George, about that point that you just made with the decline of fighting, it's less self-policing, and I do feel that players respect each other a lot less, and they're willing to go over the line. You know, it's imagine, okay, this is your brother-in-arms, and even if they're on your rival team. There's only so many hockey players, professional hockey players in the National Hockey League that reach this level. There's a certain amount of respect that you think would happen in terms of, like, you know, going after each other in terms of the health of their bodies and their minds and their heads that really surprises me. And I feel like the lack of self-policing or the decline of self-policing has only sort of, you know, driven that forward. And that's actually part of the reason why I want to at least touch briefly on the other two disciplinary incidents that I want to bring up. And one, just as the sort of, you know, what's your sense of what should happen? Because I want to, when we come back either Friday or next Monday, compare it to the backdrop of Tom Wilson, say, hey, you know, was it just the Tom Wilson frenzy that we were getting all up in arms? But here are these other incidents, and they don't compare or they do compare. And what did the NHL do? And that is the Chris Kunitz hit his elbow on Hamonic. What do you think should happen there? But also, I'm not sure, George, if you saw the punch of Bertuzzi of the Detroit Red Wings on Calvert when he sort of got checked into the boards and somebody grabbed Calvert's stick and they wouldn't let go of it on the Red Wings, bench. So he went back, he starts pulling it out, and then, from the bench, Bertuzzi, I'm just describing this for any listeners who might not have seen it, just punched him right in the face from the bench. He wasn't even on the ice, you know. And it just rings true, this idea of lack of even basic respect for each guy. I get sort of, you know, getting a little bit too hyped up in the heat of battle, the rivalry. But, George, do these two other incidents with Kunitz and then with Bertuzzi punching Calvert, you know, are they anywhere on the same level? Does the NHL need to come down hard, just as hard as we're suggesting that they should on Tom Wilson? Or, again, was it just the Tom Wilson effect that people are all up in arms and these two other incidents aren't nearly as big a deal and deserve as much attention? Or do they? So, George, what about those two incidents before we move on to the fantasy reports?
Yeah, I'm watching I saw the Kunitz hits when it happened. Now I'm watching it over and over again now on a loop. And, you know, Kunitz is probably fine with the original hit. It's as he's hitting and after the hit, his elbow goes up. And that's what looks bad here. Yeah, he's following through with the elbow. He just would have kept it down. He would have been okay here. Strange. I don't know what his thought process was here. Hamonic wasn't even going to hit him. I mean, he was really going on more. It was going to be a glancing blow at best. Hamonic looked like he was trying to poke the ball, poke around him and go. So I don't know what, Kunitz's thought process was here. Sometimes you put the elbow because you think you're going to get smacked. You're going to get hit hard. So in this case, I think the penalty probably is enough for me here. You know, Kunitz, as far as I know, doesn't have a big disciplinary history here, so I'm probably okay with this. As for what happened in the other game, I mean, that I was actually watching live. Why I was watching a Calgary-Detroit game live is beyond me. But I was watching that, and, you know, as soon as you're getting involved on the bench, you've got some problems. You're not involved in the play. What are you doing? You're on the bench. You know, and that's the first thing I thought of. Like, if I'm the ref, man, you're getting thrown out. You know, what are you doing? Well, why are you getting – you back off on the bench. Unless the guy's attacking you, you back off. You know, and you're throwing punches. You know, so once again, I think – you throw punches, in my mind, that's 5 minutes of fighting. You threw punches. And therefore, you're instigating a fight. So there's your 2 minutes for instigating and you're throwing him out. I'd give a 7-minute penalty. It's really that simple for me. And the other guy, still, you know, whatever he did, he gets penalized for. But you can just justify it right there. 5 minutes of fighting, 2 minutes for instigating, throw out. And you're done. And then once again, that'll probably stop this. And you can't tell me the refs didn't see this. We all saw it. The refs were there. You know, it's – I'm probably not suspending for this. Not unless the other guy has a history. And this is one case where history, I think, would come in. He does it once. Generally, you know, hey, I get it. One time, we all have bad games, but, you know, where it happens. You know, and I'm not automatic to suspension. You know, I'm okay with it, especially if the refs took care of it. You know, on the ice where he does get the 5-2 and the thrown out, that probably is enough for me. But if the refs missed it, you know, and another thing about the NHL with disciplinary, I might feel differently about all this if they could fine these guys heavily. But because of the CBA, what are the guys thinking? The max fine is like $5,000, which to an NHL player, I mean, I know they don't make what the other sports make, but that's pocket change. That's $5 to you and I. You know, that's not going to stop anybody from doing anything. So that's also why, you know, NHL has to be firmer on their discipline because they can't. The fines don't mean anything. They're not affecting anything. They're not a deterrent. You know, maybe the next CBA you can fix that, but they're not fixed in this CBA. So like I said, I wouldn't vote for suspension here either, but both these players couldn't. You know, I'm getting a strong talking to them. If you're here again, you'll be sitting. You know, and you hope they adhere to that. You know, you look for the guys who have history, the Tom Wilson, the Brad Marchands of the world, who over and over and over and over again, they probably have their own parking spot in the New York offices. Those are the guys that you give no benefit of a doubt to. Everybody else, I tend to want to believe that it's just, you know, shit happens. You know, and it's a game. We get up there, we get all antsy about it, we do things we shouldn't do. As long as there's no history, I'm okay.
Yeah, you know, for the most part, I'm kind of, you know, okay with your reaction here. I mean, when it comes to Kunitz, you know, considering he got ejected from the game, I'm for the most part okay if that's all that there's going to be there with Kunitz. But I do feel with the way that he brought his elbow up, and I do feel he brought it up sort of like, you know, I don't know about completely innocently, but I don't think he brought it up with vicious intent, you know. But I do feel with the way that he did bring his elbow up, it's, you know, to me it's the same thing as you need to be responsible for your stick. I understand you might have truly accidentally hit that guy in the helmet with the follow-through of your stick as you were sort of, you know, whipping around, but you need to be responsible for your stick. So, I mean, if Kunitz ends up getting a one-game suspension because of this, I would be okay with it. But if he also didn't get any additional suspension, considering he got ejected from the game, I'm okay with this, but I don't think it could be completely ignored. I do think there should at least be a hearing to have it be talked about, a minor fine or something of the like. And I understand what you're saying about the Detroit Red Wing, you know, Colorado Avalanche incident, but, I kind of feel, you know what, you're on the bench and you're starting something, you're out, you're done. That should be an automatic one-game suspension, just like you jump the bench and join a line brawl on the ice, and you're done, you're ejected, you should be suspended. You know, I think it should just be, you know, clear that way. This is complete stupidity, you know, what happened with the, you know, with the whole Calvert and Bertuzzi thing here. You know, if it was a situation that you described, George, where you're getting 5 minutes and instigator, so you're getting 7 minutes of penalty and you're going to the box, I might be mollified enough with that, you know, here, but I just think, you know, you said it best, George, a moment ago when you're saying you're not in the play, you're on the bench, you know. Unless somebody comes literally diving into the bench and is sort of on purpose making, you know, throwing their elbows and arms, slowly getting out of the bench and disentangling yourself and hitting people on purpose, like, okay, that sort of situation, I'm going to shove the guy back. You know, give him a little, you know, like face wash from that glove or whatnot. But otherwise, I think this is bordering on stupidity that needs to be addressed and should be suspended for a game. Again, I'm not going to make a big stink if that it doesn't happen that way. All right, folks, there you have our opening discussion. That took actually a pretty good portion of the show. Jen, I don't know if we're going to have any more for you today. So if you have the time, you can hang out with us. I might have an extra question for you or not. But if not, I can't guarantee it, so I wouldn't blame you if you decide to go. But we are definitely thrilled to have you back. And in this new situation where you might be able to join us on a semi-regular basis, we're definitely looking forward to that. But let's turn our attention to the fantasy report, starting off with the IR and line support as usual in Anaheim, tweaking around the lines. I mentioned on our last show how Silverberg had made it up to the top line. I kind of like that idea with Getzlaff and Raquel giving him better offensive potential. Well, that didn't really last too long. You can't understand why, because Silverberg really wasn't producing at all. Aberg back up on that top line, at least temporarily with Getzlaff and Raquel. In the last game and a half that he's been there, he does have 3 goals and 2 assists, one of those being a power play goal. So he is somebody to at least consider streaming possibly in deeper fantasy leagues as well. And therefore, Silverberg falls back down to third line with Cogliano and Kessler. And from an on-ice perspective, I'm okay with that. But from a fantasy and offensive perspective, as I said the other day, I do think it undercuts Silverberg and his value there. In Arizona, ooh, did you see that grotesque-looking hit? An eye on Grabner. That eye injury is going to keep him out indefinitely. And that new top line of Schmaltz and Galchenyuk and Keller, at least for these first 3 games, looking at least reasonably pretty good together. You know, Schmaltz has 4 points. Keller has 4 points in 3 games together. Galchenyuk just one point, being moved back to the wing. And I actually am sort of long-term curious to see how Galchenyuk will react, since he has in his past seemed really eager to play center. And that was one of the things he liked so much about this move to Arizona, that he got to play center. Really wasn't working out too well, so he moved back to wing. Is he going to sort of be pouting about that? And will that undercut his potential production moving forward? In Boston, just an update on McAvoy. It's pretty much playing out as I predicted at the beginning of last week, that I didn't think he'd be back earlier than the middle to end of this week. I did say there was a possibility of last weekend, but obviously it did not play out that way. He does continue to practice and skate with the team, and he will also be traveling with the team, but it is believed he's going to be back, not going to be back for at least another 3 or 4 games before he gets back in the lineup for the Boston Bruins. Also, Donato, who has been recalled, and I mentioned this also on Friday's show, looking pretty good, at least in the 2 games since he's come back, sort of has found his offensive swagger at least a little bit more, does have 1 goal in the 2 games since he has returned, still playing on the third line. But if Cave isn't really working out on that top line centering and Donato still trends well over the next 3 or 4 games, you still have another couple of weeks for Bergeron come back. I know I'm talking about a lot of what-ifs here, especially from a fantasy hockey standpoint, but it's really more of a, you know, hey, keep an eye on this guy. If it trends this way, it could have some positive results. In Buffalo, Sheary, with his upper body injury, has missed the last 3 games, is expected back tonight, but there is some question about that, because at practice, first of all, he's playing on the third line. So he, or at least that's who he's lining up with, so he's not at least being slotted right back in on second line with Middlestad. Obviously, going to hurt his fantasy value if you have him on your fantasy team, but also Ellie and him were sort of switching off as that third line left wing, casting a little bit of doubt that he might not be back for tonight's game. Either way, he's either back tonight or the next game for Buffalo. Just look, if you have him on your fantasy team, whether you want to put him in your starting lineup, because I don't think he's going to be on that top six, at least for the first couple of games that he does return. Also for the Sabres, Pominville with an undisclosed injury is officially out for tonight as well. Not that big of a deal, since he was already bumped off that top line with Eichel and Skinner. In Carolina, Furland and his concussion, some conflicting reports coming out of Carolina with that. There were a number of reports that he was going to make it back in the lineup yesterday, and then line rushes pregame, he was not in there, did not play, so it's a little bit confusing. Is it just another extra game that they're going to give him, and then he's going to be back for the next game, or is this sort of misinformation, and it's going to be another 3 or 4 games like we originally expected because he has a concussion? Either way, it's also additionally interesting whether Aho is going to be the center on that top line, whether you're going to see Aho, Teravainen, and Ferland back together. Aho started off the season really well, the first dozen games or so, centering that line, but it's kind of flatlined the last 10 games or so, and there's been talk about, well, maybe he's better back on the wing where he played his first 2 seasons here. So this could have a fantasy impact on a number of players, both Furland, Aho himself, and whoever the center would be, because I don't think it would be Jordan Staal long-term as it is now. If Aho is moving to the wing, I do think Victor Rask is the guy you got to keep your eye on here. either way, I do think things go back to normal once Furlan comes back, whether it's the next game or three or four games down the road. But this is a situation to keep your eye on, both for fans as well as fantasy owners who own some players on the top line in Carolina. In Colorado, Tyson Bauer with the lower body injury still listed day-to-day, missed the last four games, and does sound like he is questionable for at least another couple of games before he comes back. Limited information here, but my gut tells me that if you're in a weekly league, you're not starting him at all this week. And even if you're in a daily lineup league, fantasy-wise, you're probably not realistically putting him back in your lineup until the weekend at the earliest. In Dallas, shuffling up the lines and putting up the big three together, Spezza moves up to the right wing with Seguin and Jamie Benn, at least for their next game, which makes your second line a couple of rookies and a veteran, as Hintz is centering Shore and Radulov. Obviously, they are still trying to look for some depth scoring there, some sort of consistent second line there. And it'll be interesting to see how this will affect it, because actually, frankly, I don't think it will affect that much. But Hanzel, with that spinal fusion surgery that he had, we told you, sometime at the beginning of December and Christmas at the beginning of the year is when he'd come back. It looks like it's going to be another week and a half before he returns. But how does that affect the Dallas Stars lineup? Is he going to be playing in that top six? Is Spezza going to be remaining on the wing and Hanzel takes that second-line center spot? Or does he start off and stay in that bottom six? Don't forget, Hanzel, a nice player, more of an assist player, but he's not exactly a high offensive production player. His best years offensively were in Arizona when he was by far the best forward there, and that really wasn't saying anything, with all due respect to Mr. Hanzel. So keep that in mind. Certainly more for Dallas Stars fans rather than fantasy owners out there. Moving on to the Edmonton Oilers, just sort of drawing attention, as they did on Friday, to Chiasson, only 13% owned fantasy-wise, but he is the guy playing the right wing with Drysdale and McDavid on the top line. And it does look like those lines are going to remain consistent to what they are, at least for the next half dozen games, because it looks like Hitchcock is coming in and really trying to reestablish his defensive zone coverage and how he likes things to be done. He's going to let the all lines likely stay the way they are, and after he gets confident that his defensive zone coverage and that is learned by the team, then he will turn his attention to the offense. So look for Ryan Nugent-Hopkins to be that center with Pulju, Jarvi, and Kagula for at least the next 4 to 6 games, and Chiasson to be on that top line right wing for the next 4 to 6 games, a minimum. So if you want to take a chance, especially in deeper leagues, on a guy like Chiasson, it could be a possibility for you, especially if you need a winger. In Florida, moving up those lines, changing up those lines again, as they are also looking for some depth scoring there, putting their big three together of Huberto playing with Barkov and Hoffman. Dandanoff moves down to the second line with Kane and Vetrano. So if you are a Dandanoff owner, this gives you a little bit of nerves here. I do think his chemistry with Barkov is too good that it's hard for me to see them being split up for a long term, but obviously it gives you pause if you are a Dandanoff owner. In L.A., you probably heard by now, Kovalchuk with that ankle injury, you're going to keep him out about 4 weeks before he returns, but he really wasn't doing much before he left, so it shouldn't be that much of a hit for your fantasy team. And the L.A. Kings did claim Leipzig off waivers from the Vancouver Canucks. Also in Minnesota, just giving another heads up how they had that revolving door on that second line with Koivu and Parise. Coyle, the latest guy, getting an opportunity. Before that, it was Niederreiter. Before that, it was Granlund. So they're still looking for somebody to play that right wing with those two. Keep an eye on that situation for fantasy owners. If they find somebody to finally fit there, it could be a potential fantasy pickup as well. For the Montreal Canadiens, we talked about Shea Weber's return, and he looks just fine since he returned. 3 games, 2 goals, 1 assist, 73% owned on Friday. That was about 53% owned, so obviously his ownership percentage is spiking. If you are in one of those leagues that he is available, he is more than likely a good addition for you. Even if he's not the guy he was 5 years ago, he's, as George said on Friday's show, he's more than likely better than the fourth or even third defenseman you have on your team right now, even if he's half the man that he used to be. So go out and pick him up if he is available. In Nashville, the injuries are starting to pile up, with Forsberg getting it this time. Upper body injury has him out 4 to 6 weeks. Fiala, now your top line right wing, with Hartman giving a chance on that top line left wing with Johansson. Tolvanen recalled and looking good, at least in his first game since he came back, playing the right wing and left wing second line with Yarncroft and Craig Smith. Now, Tolvanen 16% owned, as a lot of people did try to draft him, at least late in drafts, and some of them, as you can see, have been holding on to him all year, waiting for this moment where he gets called up and gets a goal and assist in his first game. So he is somebody to look for, at least for a short-term filler in deeper leagues. And Fiala is actually also intriguing me as well, widely owned and drafted at the beginning of the year and then widely dropped for good reason because he really wasn't producing. Only 26% owned on average in ESPN and Yahoo leagues in the last five games, since he has been getting a lot of regular first-line time. First with Arvidsson out, now with Forsberg out. He does have 2 goals and 3 assists, one of those a power play goal in the last 5 games, so he could also be an interesting fantasy pickup for the next few weeks as well. In Ottawa, Lahoy, with an undisclosed injury, has him listed day-to-day, missed 1 game, and is officially out for Tuesday as well. In Philadelphia, Wayne Smith with an upper body injury is expected to play on Thursday, so that shouldn't be any sort of hiccup here. But here's a question I can throw at you, Jan, because I'm curious what you think. You haven't really been around for any of our Philadelphia Flyer discussions of the firing of Ron Hextall, as George and I talked about at length. Well, just before showtime, about 45 minutes before showtime, I saw confirmation of what I thought was going to happen. Chuck Fletcher hired as the new GM of the Philadelphia Flyers. Jan, obviously, George and I talked about this in recent shows, what's happened in Philadelphia. Curious of your take on this. Do you agree with the decision? Did you think Hextall was doing a good job and the team should have just stayed the course with him? I mean, because he never did fill that goaltending situation, which has obviously plagued them for a couple of years now. So what's your opinion of firing? And do you think Chuck Fletcher is a good match here for what senior management and ownership at least seemingly wants to do? So, Jan, Philadelphia's new GM, what do you think?
I wasn't so tremendously surprised at Hextall. I think initially when you see the shock of a guy getting fired who's been there for so long, especially with no rumors happening, that obviously has to take you by a bit of surprise. But you knew that the team had been underachieving to a certain extent. As you mentioned, the goaltending position has been an issue in Philly. You can argue all the way back to when Ron Hextall was manning between the pipes and he led them to a couple of cup finals. So that's been a repetitive issue. He's tried several Band-Aid solutions to try to find a way to remediate it unsuccessfully. I mean, clearly the hope has to be that Carter Hart ends up becoming their goalie of the future and will be their goalie of the future fairly soon. He struggled a bit in the AHL so far this year, so that's part of the reason why he hasn't gotten called up yet. Brian Elliott has been very up and down. He actually now is out on injured reserve. You had Calvin Pickard playing goal for a little bit, and other than a win against the Rangers the day after Thanksgiving, he really hadn't distinguished himself. So to me, that's probably been the bigger issue associated with that team is to, you know, the lack of a goaltender or lack of a consistent goaltender is what you've kind of mentioned. In terms of turning to Fletcher, Fletcher was the GM in Minnesota, did a pretty good job with a relatively limited budget, though he did make a couple of big splashes in terms of signing Zach Parise as well as Ryan Suter. And the issue you can argue there is both of those guys have sucked up a lot of cap space, but the production hasn't necessarily matched the cap space. But he is willing to be bold. He is willing to make big moves to try to improve a team. I think Philly, you look at having Claude Giroux, you look at having Jakub Voracek, you look at Travis Konechny being on that team, you look at Shane Gostisbehere on that team, you look at Ivan Provorov on that team. They do have some pieces to kind of build around. It's a matter of the supplemental and supporting guys. I mean, Scott Lawton's been an okay high draft pick, but he necessarily hasn't panned out. And you go up and down that lineup. You know, they have to make a major decision with Wayne Simmonds. I would expect him to be dealt, especially if Philly doesn't get into contention as a pending UFA. So they could look to replenish the system by moving Simmonds and bringing back some assets. So Fletcher does have some pieces to work with, but does need to fill in. And that was part of the problem with Minnesota. He got, I would say, quote-unquote, lucky with the acquisition of Devan Dubnyk. I don't think anybody expected Dubnyk to be the answer between the pipes when they acquired him, but he proved to be that and then some. Minnesota had that big run where we thought that, you know, when they finished at the top of the Western Conference 1 year, and then they basically faltered, for lack of a better term, in the playoffs. So Fletcher has had a good run. He led a team to the playoffs for several years in Minnesota. He was working with a limited budget to a certain extent, though, as I mentioned, was willing to be bold in terms of the moves he made. You would assume in Philly, given the history and the background of that organization, they're going to do whatever they can to try to make that run. So I expect them to be aggressive both in the trade market as well as in free agency. They got a guy who's got a bit of a pedigree, both in terms of historical based upon the lineage overall that he comes from and then the position that he had as a GM in Minnesota. So I like it as a hire. I was expecting them maybe to go a bit younger and maybe get a little bit of a fresher face as opposed to a guy who's been in the role in the past. But he's supposed to be a pretty good guy in the room, supposed to be a good guy to work for, which definitely will help. So I like the hire overall, but as we know, if he doesn't find a way to remediate the goaltending position, if Carter Hart isn't the answer, no matter who they bring in as GM is going to struggle, and Philly's not going to get to that next level.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice breakdown, and I think you're right. I think he's a good match, especially you know, with making this change in season. He's a good match for what it seems like the senior management ownership want to do here. You know, and I think that's probably the biggest reason why, at least in my shoes, from my perspective, why you go with a selection rather than a newer or a younger guy. I think if this was done in the off season, I think you'd have a much better chance of having somebody a little bit of a younger gun. You know, where Philadelphia could sort of take their time and get to know somebody to see if it was the right attitude. Here you have Chuck Fletcher, as you said, he's already got a history, and it seems to match up more in line with what Philly wants to do. Outside that goaltending position, which you so well broke down, I think the other biggest question for Fletcher is what he's going to do with Haskell. I know George was of the opinion on the when we did the show the other day that it seems to be leaning in the direction that Haskell might be replaced unless this team turns it around sooner rather than later. And I would tend to agree because I don't think you can put all those issues that Philly's had. And not that they're the worst team in terms of issues outside the goaltending, but they definitely have some issues. Some of it does seem to be leaning towards it being Haskell that is responsible for that. And there was some rumors that Hextall was protecting Haskell and didn't want to fire him where senior management wants to be. So that's another issue. Sort of keep an eye on the situation as it develops over the next couple of weeks, couple of months. All right, turning our attention back to the IR port and line support in Pittsburgh. Hornquist did return for Saturday's game after missing three games and returns to playing on the second line with Malkin and Pearson, moving Kessel down to the third line with Broussard and Aston Reese as well, with that first line being consistent of Crosby, Gutsell, and Dominic Simon at the moment. With Meyer still out with that upper body injury, still hasn't listed as day-to-day for the San Jose Sharks, missed the last three, is questionable for Wednesday's game. There is some whispers, not a whole lot of information here, but some whispers and people implying that at least by the end of the weekend, beginning next week, at the latest, Meyer should go back. That is unconfirmed. I wouldn't depend on that information, but that seems it is trending at the moment. While he is out, they've moved Pavelski on the right wing with Hurdle and Couturier, Thornton, LeBlanc, and Sorensen being that third line, and that line that started the season of Demelia and Kane and Donskoy is also part of your top nine as well, at least until Meyer does return. In St. Louis, the injuries piling up to some guys who, well, are always injured. Fabry with an upper body injury, left Saturday's game. No update on him today. They're not practicing today, so they're not going to expect any updates until at least tomorrow at the earliest. Same thing that goes with Steen, who also had to leave the game on Saturday. Well, actually, he did not play on Saturday. He had to leave the game before. Peter Angelo, upper body injury. He's got him listed as day-to-day. Also missed Saturday's game as well. In Tampa Bay, you know, just the other day, or it was actually more like pushing a week, Palat said, you know, hey, I'm getting close to coming back. I don't know where I'm even going to play in this lineup. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get back into this lineup. They're playing so well. All the guys are so good. So he's ready and he's healthy. And where does he land? On the top line with Steven Stamkos and Gord. Not a bad place to squeeze back into the lineup. Second line remains point. Tyler Johnson and Kucherov. J.T. Miller still playing on that third line with Cirelli and Killorn as well. And in Toronto, we've talked the last couple of shows about Nylander and the possibility of him coming back. Obviously, on Saturday, we got that confirmation. He is back. But when I talked to you, George, about it, I focused on Nylander, how fantasy owners should navigate his return, whether they should put him right back in the lineup and whatnot. But there is a key player here who we've briefly talked about who's going to be directly affected or potentially directly affected that we haven't talked about, and that is Kapanen, George. From a fantasy hockey perspective, he's obviously replaced Nylander so far this season on that second-line right wing. Played well with Matthews before he went out, playing pretty well with Kadri once Matthews was out for a while. From a fantasy hockey perspective, George, are you selling on Kapanen? Are you too worried that Nylander is going to come in and attack him? Even if Nylander is worked into the lineup slowly, as we both suggested we thought was going to happen on Friday's show, still that kind of implies that 3 or 4 weeks down the line, Nylander is going to be back on that second line right wing spot. Did you see enough of Kapanen and Kadri together that you're still keeping him on your fantasy team, at least in a deeper league, even if he moves down to the third line? Or are you looking to maybe trade him to somebody who's a little less wear in your hockey league, or just outright drop him because you think his production is going to dry up? So, Kapanen, George, how would you handle owning him right now if you have him on your fantasy team? If he was a free agent pickup for you once that spot opened up, once he got moved up into the top six. So, George, Kapanen, what do you think?
Well, the time of trade and for anything of value has gone away. I mean, you waited too long now. There's a chance, I mean, hey, your league could be different. Maybe you have guys who aren't paying attention and they're only looking at the numbers here. But he's more of a bench player now. I don't think I'd release him. Once again, your league could be different. You could be in a 10-team league. It could be somebody else out there. But in most leagues, I'm probably holding on to him. Bench spot. Injuries happen. You know, Nylander could – we've seen this before in other sports, hockey as well. Guys who don't have a training camp come in, play, all of a sudden, a groin injury, you know, a hamstring injury, calf, whatever it might be, lower leg, soft tissue was the big word nowadays. So I'm not letting him go. He's probably not my starting lineup anymore either. But like I said, as far as trading him, that sell high point is gone now. Now you'd be selling low and really just hoping for something back you can use here. You can try. There's no harm in trying, but odds are I would think most league members are very well aware that Nylander signed and could return at some point this week.
All right. Some good perspective on Kapanen and the realities there. Let's turn our attention to the goalie report, George. Last goalie report was a little bit more encouraging, at least in the overall, than the prior ones from a couple of weeks. Can you make it a back-to-back thing so, you know, fantasy owners aren't crying when they finish listening to the show? Or do you have some more bad news about what's going on between the pipes around the National Hockey League? George?
Yeah, as far as the goalie report, it's really actually not that bad. Murray is skating for Pittsburgh. It doesn't look like his return is imminent. He did leave the ice early there, but he is skating with the team, a good sign. I guess the natural progression, next step here. But like I said, he's not on his way to coming back anytime soon here, or at least not in the – I certainly don't think he's returning this week. The Rangers are playing games with a backup goaltenders. We see so many teams do this. Georgiev got down to the AHL. Tokarski called up. This could be a reaction to how well – or I should say how poorly Georgiev played over the weekend, or it could be just the fact that they think, oh, you know what, he played poorly because we don't play him enough. Lundqvist is playing so well that, you know, we're going with him over and over again. We got to get him some game action in the AHL so he can be a solid backup there. So we'll see with there. But overall, really not that important for fantasy hockey. Dallas, Hudobin is going to start with the Stars tonight. We saw that Bishop is back. There's nothing, no new injury or anything like that. They're just starting Hudobin tonight. So you're good there. Tampa Bay, they're also made a change at backup goaltender. Now, they recalled Edward Pasquale back to the NHL and sent down Connor Ingram. I think that's because they have a back-to-back immediately this week. And I think what they're doing there is that we already know that Domingue's going to start tonight against the Devils, and I expect Pasquale to go tomorrow against Detroit. I think that's how they're going to play it there. That's why they called Pasquale back up. They did send him down to get in some game action. The Lightning have been riding Domingue hard, which is probably good for Vasilevsky owners, because if this is going to be longer-term injury, I don't think they'd be riding Domingue as hard. They would have given him at least one game off so far, and they haven't. So I think they feel like, you know, Domingue's going to be sitting for most of the rest of the year anyway. We can ride him hard here while Vasilevsky's out here. Once again, you're reading tea leaves there. At least I'm reading tea leaves there. But I think that's a good sign there. Arizona, Ranta could rejoin the club as soon as tomorrow. If not, maybe later this week. But he's on the way to recovery there. Hunter Miska was sent down to the AHL. Edmonton, Koskinen starting tonight. He is the starter in Edmonton now. And everybody, we can all deny it any way we want, but he is the starter for now. Do I think this is a long-term thing? That's a little bit more iffy. But as we've mentioned, when they made the coaching change, Hitchcock has no allegiance to Talbot. You know, he has none. He's going to start the best goalie for him. And right now, that's by far Koskinen. So Koskinen goes tonight and probably should be started for your fantasy team, and certainly should be Grant, who's out there on your waiver wire. Florida, we had heard that we – talked about it on Friday, actually, that there was a chance Luongo could return on Saturday. He did not. Now there's a chance he can return tomorrow. But the bottom line is this. Got the lower body injury. He will be back at some point. Right? I would think this week. Could be tomorrow. Could be a little later. But either way, you are going to get Luongo back here, so be ready to activate him. One sign that maybe his activation won't come tomorrow is that although Luongo practiced today, Hutchinson is still with the team. And you would think if they were positive that he was coming back, they would have sent Hutchinson back down to the AHL. So keep that in mind there. That's really it. There's no news on Vasilevskiy as far as that's concerned. We saw Quick came back last week. So a lot of our injured goalies are returning, which is kind of a nice thing.
Very nice indeed. Nice to hear. Oh, the goalie report that isn't, a triage report for sure. All right, George, another follow-up question I always ask you, recommending for possible streamer pickups for goalies for fantasy hockey, whether it be in a weekly league or a daily lineup league. We usually look first at those teams that are playing four games this week for those low-owned number one goalies who might be good pickups, but of course those backup goalies that might get a nice start this week. So looking at the landscape, even though there's just six teams with four games this week, George, who pops out to you as some good streaming possibilities for fantasy owners out there?
Yeah, quite a week in the NHL. First thing, I think it's just a holiday week, and it is, so I wonder if that came into play with it. Well, I don't think it would, but I was just surprised that only six teams have four games this week. I would have thought more be involved there. Two games for Carolina, one game for the Rangers. So as well as Lundqvist has been playing, you probably want to stay away there. Not that you should. I mean, once again, one game can be good enough for you, but if you're looking for volume, you're not going to get it with the Rangers here. In Carolina, you're probably not starting McElhinney either. Other teams that play six games, Boston, they're back-to-backs over the weekend, Toronto and Ottawa. Pollock would still be a solid start there. So we'll talk about that more on Friday, but he's somebody you could certainly get in your lineup. Calgary, who is the starter? Is it Rittich? Is it Mike Smith? I said it before, I'll say it again. If Rittich is available on your waiver wire, you should grab them anyway. He should not be available. If he is, go get him. He's more than just a backup. He's at least a quasi-starter there. You know, Mike Smith has played better of late. Maybe Mike Smith got the message, got the kick in the butt, and all of a sudden he's going to have what we expected from him this season. Edmonton, already mentioned, Koskinen is your starter. You want him. If he's available, same thing. Go get him. It's been a weird season in the NHL as far as goaltenders. Koskinen, Rittich, several other guys. You can go out there and grab Halak for a while. Also had a starting job in Boston. They're available. They're out there. Ottawa, I'm going to stay away from Ottawa. I barely want Craig Anderson on my team. Tampa Bay, I already said I expect Pasquale to play tomorrow. And the way they've been using Domingue, I expect Domingue gets tonight's start. And then he gets Boston, Colorado later in the week. So you're probably only getting one start, but it's a good start. It is, granted, back-to-back. We don't like back-to-back, especially the second half. But it's still Tampa versus Detroit. I'll take my chances there. So, once again, if you're in a deeper league, you're desperate. Pasquale is a guy you can certainly go after there. Vegas is the last team that plays four games this week. They're back-to-backs over the weekend. Once again, Subban, if you're really desperate, but he has not been playing well. So I think you want to calm that down here. So it's the normal suspects this week. Halak, Rittich, Koskinen, but these guys should already all be grabbed anyway. The low-owned guy that's available out there you could go out and get would be Pasquale. I think they haven't announced anything, but I'd be shocked if they go back-to-back with Domingue. I think Pasquale gets tomorrow against Detroit.
All right, George, thanks as always for your recommendation and guidance for those fantasy owners out there looking for goaltenders. Thank you both gentlemen for sort of sticking with us a little bit over time than normally expected. I'm going to let both you guys go as I wrap up our skater waiver wire recommendations. Turning our attention to those skaters, George just mentioned the six teams, I should say, that have four games this week. And at least from an offensive perspective, they're all at least reasonably good. Boston, I know they got the injury issues and the lack of depth scoring, but I kind of like the schedule this week. Florida, Tampa Bay, those goaltenders, Tampa Bay is playing pretty well, and Ving is racking up wings. But he's also given up a lot of goals, So Florida, Tampa Bay, Toronto, Ottawa, all those teams you could score against. So, if you're looking at Krejci or maybe at DeBrusk, especially in shallower leagues or even deeper leagues, they are both widely available too. They are sort of interesting as well. Calgary, Edmonton, Ottawa don't have the greatest schedule, but if you're looking for like some cumulative stats like shots and hits and things like that, they might be intrigued with some of those guys from those teams. Tampa Bay, it's hard to not like some guys there. I don't have an official recommendation, but he's a guy who should probably be pretty available for you, who is widely, because of the injury and him not playing of late. In the Vegas Golden Knights, I like them as well. They start off with a tough matchup against Washington, but then Chicago, LA, and Dallas to round out the week. So those are the teams that jump out at me as some good possibilities in terms of the regular three-game weeks. from a fantasy perspective. Colorado playing Pittsburgh, Florida, and Tampa Bay is particularly appealing, even though all three games are on the road. Montreal playing a home-home against Ottawa, and then Chicago is also kind of appealing as well, especially that top six of those guys, you know, Domi, Shaw, Druid in particular, being playing pretty well as a line, also have some availability as well. Toronto playing Buffalo, Detroit, and Boston is intriguing as well. And Winnipeg against the Islanders, St. Louis, and Philadelphia is a pretty good schedule. In terms of specific player recommendations, somebody who I mentioned last week for this week, I'll remind you, Cody Eakins for the Vegas Golden Knights. I know he's not that much of a sexy pick, but since he has taken over as a second-line center since Stastny and Hula have both gone down, he has played pretty well. The Vegas center is only 11% owned on average in ESPN and Yahoo Leagues for the last 13 games, 6 goals, 5 assists, power play point, 2 shorthanded points, and, of course, playing with Pacioretty and Tuck on that second line. I already mentioned the pretty good schedule that he has for this week. If you're looking for a defenseman, how about Clifton from the Edmonton Oilers? The defense is only 54% owned on average in ESPN and Yahoo Leagues, but he has gotten a bump in time, and he was already playing your basically top-tier minutes already, but has gotten a bump in time, about a minute and a half, 2 minutes extra game he's playing since Hitchcock took over. And in those 6 games since he's taken over, 2 goals, 4 assists, 3 power play points, averaging 4.5 shots per game. Don't forget, for a defenseman, if you're getting 1.5 shots per game on average, that is a great number from them. So 4.5 shots per game is even better than that, obviously. And he's got 4 games this week, Dallas, St. Louis, Minnesota, and Calgary as well. Looking for a winger, how about Dustin Brown? The L.A. right wing is only 40% owned in ESPN and Yahoo Leagues. For the last 5 games, he has been heating up, and he does have a history of putting some nice stretches together, good 3-4-week stretches in the last 5 games. 5 goals, 2 assists, plus 3, 2 power play goals, 4 shots on goal per average, playing with Kopitar and Aiello on that top line. You got Arizona, New Jersey, and Vegas this week, and even bleeding into next week, starting off with the Detroit Red Wings, so you can get a nice 4-game stretch out of him as well. And if you're looking to take a little bit of a chance on another player playing 4 games this week, Michael Backlund, the Calgary Center, is only 18% owned in the last 4 games. He's got 2 goals, 3 assists, plus 5, a shorthanded point, playing on the second line with Matt Tkachuk and Sam Bennett. And they've sort of slowly been getting some nice chemistry together. Haven't been putting up a ton of points as a trio, but they look like they're starting to play pretty nicely together and have some long-term offensive potential there as well. And as I also said, Calgary is also playing 4 games this week. Columbus, Minnesota, Nashville, and Edmonton. Kind of a tough schedule this week. But again, if you're looking for somebody with some cumulative stats like shots, if you have face-offs in your league, Backlund would also be particularly good as well. All right, folks, thanks for staying with us a little bit over time today. But we had a ton to talk about, had our special guest, Jen Levine, with us, and, of course, George Kurtz, as always. I hope we filled all your hockey needs with all the information that we have. Have a good hockey week, everybody. We'll talk to you on Friday.